you ever stop to wonder if you're awake or dreaming? I do, especially when I'm enjoying too good to be true Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer a variety of blends and roasts, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this magnificent coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or enjoy regular deliveries by joining the Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is completely flexible and customizable. It's got all the convenience with none of the commitment. And if you tell Sparkplug that you heard about them here, they're going to give you 20% off your next order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. And that's all one word with the number 100. Start enjoying the coffee of your dreams right now by going to sparkplugcoffee.com.
Do you think Tom Cruise drinks coffee?
He does his own stunts, so script calls for it.
Not a drinker. Not a drug guy. Scientology. Maybe his one vice
he's
is
high on
coffee.
Feedings.
Possibly caffeine. Sparkplug support! Sparkplug support! I will always think of this movie whenever I hear Good Vibrations by the Beach Boys. Because of that tech support scene. Hit that music.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Open your eyes. Open your eyes. Hi there, movie monkeys. And thanks for slathering the 408th Ellis's Analysis all over your day. We here at the Top 100 Project kicked off this podcast venture in March 2013 when we set out to chronicle each and every one of the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of groovy-ass American motion pictures. We spoiled the secrets of each of those films, just as we'll spoil the secrets of this one. I'm the citizen dildo who shuffles along dejectedly and often wears a mask. Pandemic reference. The Phantom of the Dakota, Ryan Ellis. This guy lives in the Dakota. Rosemary's Baby, John Lennon's
John
Building.
Lennon, yeah.
And here's the pleasure delayer who has a fear of heights, but is quite literally living the dream, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
Also known as Tom Cruise or David Ames. Bev Ames. Okay, the coming attractions opinion question for this week's picture. The fourth puzzle film in 2001 that I can think of, maybe there's more, but the four big ones, Donnie Darko, Mulholland Drive, Memento, they're all in our archives. And now finally we get to Vanilla Sky, the fourth big puzzle picture that year. But this isn't about that. This is about the star, Tom Cruise. Discounting Nicole Kidman because she'd be the runaway winner of this game if we included her. Which of Tom Cruise's past wives or girlfriends is the best actress? Mimi Rogers, Katie Holmes, they're the two wives. Of course, Kidman as well, but we're excluding her. Penelope Cruz, or reportedly, Rebecca De Mornay, when they did Risky Business together. Apparently they dated. And like I said last week, promoing this, apparently he dated Cher. I don't believe that one, so I didn't include her.
Yeah, I saw that too, and I was like, maybe.
Plus, if I included Cher in this, then you'd have to go with her, because I think she'd be the easy choice. Just like if you said Kidman was part of this, easy choice.
Well, can I cheat and say Hayley Atwell, because apparently they're dating at the moment.
I did not know that.
That is the rumor. She's in the newest Mission Impossible movie, I guess. And so the rumor is that they are an item. But actually, I'm going to say Rebecca De Mornay, because she wins this by a mile. Mimi Rogers has never left the faintest impression on me in any part she's ever been in. And Katie Holmes, I love her. I root for her. She's not an excellent actress.
We wouldn't know her name if she wasn't pretty.
She's so cute and affable, and I like her so much, but every time I see her in anything, she disappoints me.
Yeah, she wouldn't have succeeded at all if she weren't a good-looking woman, is my point. But Rebecca De Mornay is also my choice for a few reasons, but the main one, of course, is the underrated, as far as at least her performance goes, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle.
Yeah. Why wasn't she a star? Hollywood did her dirty.
She's also in Backdraft, I believe, right before The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. And she still keeps working, I think, to this day, but I guess she's the best choice. I would maybe give Cruz, as in Penelope Cruz, more of a shot at this if you just include the Spanish language films.
Absolutely.
But as I said to you when this was over and you asked what I thought of it, I said a few things, but then I got to Penelope Cruz and said, she's terrible. She's just dreadful in this movie. Hollywood wanted her to be a star, and she was not good in this. She was not good in Captain Corelli's Mandolin, and she was not good in Blow. And she was nominated for a Razzie for all three as a combined performance.
Poor
and
girl.
I'm not going to try to pile on her too hard. Because she has been good in other things, but in those three movies, especially this one, not good. And this is Hollywood trying to jam her down our throats.
Maybe it's just fate being like, you have a great thing going in Spain. Why would you want to live in Los Angeles when you can live in Spain?
When she won the Oscar for playing a Spanish language character primarily in Woody Allen's movie Vicky Cristina Barcelona, she speaks English here and there, but mostly it's Spanish. That's part of the humor. She won't speak English, and then Javier Bardem, and I believe they're married now, right? He makes her speak English to Rebecca Hall, Scarlett. Anyway, the point is that she is speaking her native language. But it's not even just a language thing. Although, as I said to you too, what the fuck is she saying in this movie half the time?
I don't really struggle to understand her.
Oh, I do, and I've seen the movie many times.
My enduring impression, because I only ever saw this once in the theaters when it first came out, was just how annoying she is.
That's true, too.
Her character is annoying. Just with her big puffy coat and waving her hand through the hologram and her just too cuter than words. Get out of here. It's way overkill and totally annoying.
I'm going to jump to the nutshell right now because we're talking about her so much. Mm. I have two nutshells, actually, so I'll do the second part I was going to do later right now, and it does apply. And I'm going to quote one of the great moments in any comedy scene in TV history. We've been rewatching The Office. I never saw it before until just recently this year, and you hadn't seen this far into the series. But Ellie Kemper as Erin, that moment where she talks about Holly, I don't get it. I'm sorry. I just don't get it.
It was such a great running gag. The Office is totally new to us, and we're 10 years behind everybody else. But yeah, we just got to that part, and we're loving it.
Michael and Holly, Michael and Holly, Michael and Holly, cut to, I don't get it.
Well, She says, I don't see it.
Well, I was looking that up, and I saw I don't get it. So either the internet is wrong about that. I couldn't find the actual clip, but I saw some GIFs and things, or GIFs and pictures and stuff. So whatever it is, I don't get it or see it. All right, I don't get it, I don't see it. Point is, Hollywood, Cameron Crowe, whoever, with Penelope Cruz, I don't see it either. So Life Part 2 was released nearly 20 years ago by Paramount on December 14th, 2001. It tripled its budget worldwide, so while it wasn't a blockbuster by Tom Cruise standards, it did pretty well. But the movie's almost 20 years old, Bev, so it might help if you remind everyone what it's about with the Vanilla Sky Skinny.
Tom Cruise is David Ames, the hot playboy heir to a publishing dynasty. He has everything going for him until he's left disfigured and in pain after a terrible car crash. Desperate to get his life back, David undergoes experimental surgery that restores his face, but the price appears to be his sanity. The walls between dream and reality start crumbling around him, and he descends into madness, ultimately murdering the love of his life and going to prison. Then a nice man comes along and explains plainly to him to relax. It was just a dream.
Tech support! Edmund Ventura. I'm looking at the credit list here, and apart from David Ames, Edmund Ventura, and Kurt Russell's character McCabe doesn't even have a first name according to this, but so many of them, okay, well, two key ones at least, are comic book-esque alliteration. Sophia Serrano, Julie Gianni, his two ladies, and also Thomas Tipp. Third person. Three people in the movie, so that is Timothy Spall's character, have that alliteration thing going on. Okay, so the actual nutshell, other than, I don't see it, I don't get it, about Penelope Cruz. Move the fuck on. Regarding both Brian, Jason Lee's character, but especially Cameron Crowe's character. He doesn't love you. You may love him. I don't blame you for being unhappy about it. You can talk about it for 10 years with your therapist and your friends if you want to, but if he doesn't love you back, then move the fuck on.
You said Cameron Crowe's character.
Cameron Diaz's character. There's two Cameras in this movie, not a common name, and they work together in this film. You're right. Okay, so Cameron Diaz's character, not her fault, although I don't think her performance is as good. A lot of people seem to think, because she was nominated for both a SAG and a Golden Globe for this, and a lot of people talked about the Oscar as well.
She's okay.
Yeah, she's okay.
She's kind of like Katie Holmes to me. I totally love her. I want her to succeed. Every so often she gets cast perfectly. She's a better actress than Katie Holmes, but yeah, she doesn't have a range.
I don't buy Cameron Diaz as a psycho killer or somebody who would flip out and drive a car off a bridge.
I agree.
But her in There's Something About Mary or in some of the other, being John Malkovich, which is so against type, I bought those things. It's not like she can't act.
That movie.
She definitely can act. I saw, what's it called again? Not Hot Teacher, Bad Teacher, again recently for the second time, and still enjoyed the movie. It's still a pretty funny one. But I don't love her in this either, and of course I've already made clear that I don't really love Penelope Cruz. And I also always said Tom Cruise should have been nominated for an Oscar as certainly, and I still stand by this one, Haley Joel Osment in AI, which we covered a few months ago. That I stand by. Haley Joel Osment in that movie, man, where is he at the awards that year? At least be one of the five. And I thought Cruise was the other one. I thought they both should have been in what was a good category in 2001. But now seeing it again, no.
Okay, good, because I was making a face. I'm not going to deny that he has some great moments in this movie. His energy's a lot. He gives us a pretty unlikable character that is never redeemed. And the ending He really leaves me wanting. Cameron Crowe is a director that has gotten some absolute career best performances.
Including out of Cruise.
Tom Cruise. My favorite Tom Cruise movie is probably Jerry Maguire.
Certainly on the shortlist for me, too.
It is definitely one of my favorite performances of his. He is so wonderful. There's so much depth and vulnerability in that performance. It's great. He's perfect casting. But I think this movie, one of its several flaws, is that it's cast really poorly. Every part.
The big three, then, especially.
Is cast wrong, yeah.
Well, you know what's funny you bring up Jerry Maguire is that I think Chris and I talked about this when we covered that. A lot of movies we're going to talk about that these actors have done, some of their other big titles, Chris and I have covered them for the Scoring at the Movies series, so they've been in sports movies, at least one of them. And, of course, Cruise has been in several. Days of Thunder is a big one. Color of Money, I think, was the first time we ever covered him. He was supposed to be in Without Limits, but did produce that. So he's got a lot of movies that we've covered on that channel. You and I have only done him now three times, I think. Rain Man, Interview the Vampire, and this. And Rain Man also, by the way, is one of his best performances.
So wait, you've never covered Jerry Maguire?
With Chris. So here's the point.
Okay.
So here's the point. I think we talked about that in that podcast. As much as that's a great performance and one of the better movies of the 90s, Crowe's best movie, although I do love Almost Famous, so okay, one of his two best movies. And one of the best things Cruise ever did. But I don't think that they painted, so Cruise and Crowe, that he was ever the asshole they portray him as being until he has his big moment. We don't see the way he was as the shark agent, really, the way they talk about it. Very brief glimpses of it.
Yeah.
And it's funny because Cruise seems like the kind of person, what was it, Christian Bale that said about how he did American Psycho. In a way he was doing Cruise, it was the intensity, but nothing behind the eyes. Which is funny because Tom Cruise seems like he's somebody who's got a pretty good life and always did. And I think knows that. He's been married many times, many girlfriends. He's got kids. If he is an empty person, and if Bale's analysis is correct, then I don't know why. But okay, fine. But I don't know that he portrayed the shark character that much. And we don't really see it that much in Jerry Maguire. The flip side is, the same two guys making this movie 5 years later, if he's too nice in Jerry Maguire, he's not nice enough in this movie. He doesn't say, and this is probably very intentional by Crowe, when his face has been fixed and Sophia's with him and their life is fine now, but all that's probably a dream. Do you love me? He doesn't answer her. He does at the end, just like I guess in Jerry Maguire, where he finally says to Dorothy, I love you. You complete me. Everyone knows that, of course, in that movie. But he didn't say it to Dorothy earlier when she said, why do you love me? Why do you love me? They both challenge each other. He doesn't have an answer because he doesn't want to say it. So in a way, this is the same character. And I think Cruise, as always, is working very hard. But there's a disconnect in both movies, and it doesn't really cause a problem in Jerry Maguire, but it does in this one. And the other thing about this performance I don't like as much as I used to is that when he plays the Master of the Universe guy in the early part of the film, he seems like he's drunk or stoned at all times in that, whatever it is, 15 minutes before the car accident. When he plays the guy with the wrecked face and the bad arm and the limp and all that stuff, is he overdoing it? I don't know. I think he's actually quite good in those scenes.
He's overdoing it a little.
But okay. He's somebody who's had his whole life taken from him.
Igor yells everything. It's a pretty exaggerated performance of somebody who's upset about losing something.
But I don't really buy him in the early scenes when he's just playing, in some ways, Tom Cruise. Does that make sense? Although the funny thing, too, is that David Ames had this handed to him. The seven dwarfs on the board don't respect him, don't like him, want to take his company. If all that's real. We'll get into that in a few seconds, too. But if that's real, they want to take things from him he doesn't deserve, which is also a crock because it's his father's wish. Whether he deserves it or not, it's not your company. It's David Ames Sr.'s company, and this is what he willed to his son.
Sure, but imagine how frustrating it is when you have earned your place on the board by being smart enough and good enough. And not only does the job go to the boss's kid, but the boss's kid is a total flighty...
Comes in late every day.
Yeah, he's a gadabout. He comes in, they can't even get him to approve a title. As a person who frequently has to wait for people to approve things, I felt that... when they're like, just tell me if you want white or orange. And he's like, tell you later. You're ruining their life. They have to cancel their dinner plans now because you can't just pick a color.
Right, but it is his company. So Cruise is playing a guy who had everything handed to him and he didn't earn it. But Tom Cruise himself, that's not true about him. We know, if you don't want to buy this, you don't have to buy this. If you don't like the guy for whatever reason, he doesn't work hard. That's a crock.
Oh, yeah.
He always works hard. He's one of those actors, and I've probably said this lots of times on this podcast and Scoring at the Movies, who's trying so hard to be good in this movie, which I somewhat respect and, of course, somewhat can be mocked. But at least he's putting forth the effort. He always does. He always wants his movies to be as good as they can be. But he is a probably B-minus actor at best compared to some other people who can just naturally do it. You don't have to think about it at all or whatever. They do the work, you don't see it, and they don't talk about it, or you don't feel like I'm seeing it on screen necessarily, all the work he did, and that kind of stuff. So it's interesting that he's playing a character who had everything handed to him, but he himself is somebody who didn't have a father for most of his life, which of course is the storyline in this, and in many of his movies where he has daddy issues. But Cruise did have to work his ass off to get where he is. But also, I guess the question could be made about, we said Katie Holmes, Penelope Cruz as well. Would we know who they are if they weren't good looking? If Tom Cruise looks like he does when he has the makeup and all that stuff. And I also remember when he was promoting this movie, he could do the jaw thing. Obviously, he didn't have the big scar on his face when he was sitting down in some promotional chair. But he could make his face do that saggy jaw thing, and the interviewer was amazed by that. So it wasn't just makeup that made him look as bad as he does. Although when he wears the mask, especially in the nightclub, isn't that even more distracting than when he's got the banged up face?
Oh yeah, 100%.
When the guy who is in, we said something about Mary, he and Cameron Diaz don't share scenes in this movie, but he's Warren from There's Something About Mary, the brother, who's the bartender, who won't look Cruise in the face. Cruise's face looks terrible. But it's not that bad. You can't even look at him.
And people are polite. They wouldn't do a double take and then show the disgust on their face. People are better than that.
It's also interesting that when David's getting drunk that night at the bar, he and the bartender seem to have clicked. So the bartender got over that, although maybe he's getting drunk himself with tequila shots, but they clicked pretty well.
But also, who hasn't known somebody in their life that has some kind of disfigurement? It's surprising how quickly you just get used to it and get over it, and that's just their face, and you move on. It's not the end of the world to have your face disfigured. Now, if you looked like Tom Cruise, and that was a huge part of your identity, that you were hot and rich and you had the world at your feet, and then you lose one of those things, and suddenly your face doesn't look good anymore, that would hurt. That would be hard on his ego.
A key thing as well, though, with the character is he's always in pain. I've forgotten that because I haven't seen
the
movie in
quite
a long time.
That's important.
It's one thing for him not to look that good, because I was wondering the same thing, which is, okay, so, and I forgot the arm also is a real problem for him until they fix that.
But what does he say when they're like, we can fix your face and we can certainly do something about your arm? And he says, fuck my arm, because he doesn't care about his arm. It's his face that he really wants fixed. In his fantasy, it's the mask coming off. He never even talks about whether the headaches are gone or not. The big emotional moment is when they take the mask off and they see that his face looks the way that it did before.
Which, of course, would never happen, even in sci-fi, because
no.
You have to have some kind of... It might be very subtle, but there'd be some kind of... It'd be like Tina Fey's scar on her jawline, at the very least.
Right, exactly.
Tina Fey was...
I didn't even know it was there until
somebody
else told me about it.
Slashed her in the face when she was a kid, something like that, in her
like
front yard.
Or something.
So, depending on how she smiles or frowns or what have you, you don't necessarily notice it, but then if she does smile or frown, you do notice it. It would at least be that on his face for the rest of his life, even in a sci-fi world, but of course, I'm putting logic to an illogical situation. Is the entire movie, from the beginning, a dream? Because the first thing we hear is Sophia Serrano, a character he's not met yet. He meets her, what's supposed to be, that day or a few days later. He doesn't know Sophia yet, but Penelope Cruz is definitely the one doing the Abre los ojos, which, of course, is the name of the movie Alejandro Amenábar did that Crow adapted.
Yeah, this is a remake of a Spanish film.
Which she was in as Sophia as well.
Yeah, she plays the same part.
So she says that, and then it's open your eyes, so the English version of the exact same phrase. But he doesn't know her yet. So why is he hearing that? And of course, it's also that it's the dream, and that's where the famous shot from this movie, he's alone in Times Square, driving his car, gets out, and of course, because it's a Tom Cruise movie, starts to run. And what it is they shut down Times Square on a Sunday morning for a lot of money. And if you look, apparently you can see some people around here and there in windows and that kind of thing.
You gotta look, because...
I didn't notice it.
Pretty incredible, actually.
But then again, as they say on, I think it was the IMDb, I read this, that even if that was the case, that would actually in some ways fit. Because if this is part of his paid-for dream with L.E., that if people are watching him, they could be other tech support people. They could be other people working for the company that are seeing what's going on. So he has this dream. He wakes up. Then he hears Cameron Diaz's voice on his alarm saying, open your eyes, David, open your eyes. But why do you ever hear Sophia's voice if he doesn't know her yet? So that's why I felt like from at least the second viewing of this movie many years ago, the whole thing is a dream. And there's lots of speculation as well that it could be Brian, his friend, Jason Lee, writing a book. And that's all this is just a book about his good friend who maybe has this life, but I'm going to tear that life down because I'm a little bit jealous of him.
There's other hints too. Brian, for instance, when at his birthday party, he shows up wearing a t-shirt that says fantasy. The thing that stuck out to me is at some point he's hanging out with Sophia and the TV's on, and there's a little news story about the dog that's frozen and then comes back to life. And she says, oh, I've seen this 400 times. It's not a commercial. It's a news item. Why would she have seen this 400 times?
She has nothing else to do in life. She just watches TV and news stories over and over again.
How would you even accidentally watch this hundreds of times or even more than once? And then I thought, well, if he's been dreaming for 150 years, perhaps he and Sophia have watched that story hundreds of times before.
Wow. Fun life. Here's a nutshell of a third nutshell for this movie. And I know I've used this phrase before, but it does fit with what we're talking about right now. Stealing it from Spinal Tap. Full-time dreamer. Michael McKean has wanted to be that, a full-time dreamer. So what's your take? Is the whole thing a dream? Is the movie, as they literally show it to us, what happened? Is it Brian writing a book, or is it something altogether different? There's at least four interpretations of this movie that are pretty common, and I just gave you two or three of them right there.
My inclination is to take the film at face value, and I think that they're just trying to throw us some curveballs to make us think that the film is deeper than it is, because it actually is incredibly shallow for a film
that's fitting for this guy.
Yeah, they do not pull it off, but there are lots of reasons to question David's perception of things, and maybe the film is suggesting that whether it's a dream or it's reality, we can't trust what we're seeing because we're seeing David's version of things. There's a moment in the nightclub where David's having his breakdown and he's saying to Sophia all these things that happened at the party that we saw happen. She's describing, I think, Julie to him or something like that, and he's telling her exactly what she said, and she says, kind of indignant about it, "I would never say that. That doesn't sound like me at all."
But the movie showed those scenes earlier.
But the movie showed those scenes, and then Sophia is saying to us in what is supposed to be reality, "What are you talking about? I never said that." Implying that either she's lying, which the movie really doesn't paint her to be a liar.
She's not a liar.
Yeah, she's reliable, which means, are we not supposed to believe what we saw earlier? Is that his fantasy? Is that his dream?
I think he ordered the torture dream / fantasy. Yeah, I think he wants to torture himself and punish himself that much, because why would he pick the splice after he had the accident and he's dealing with all these problems and Sophia can help rescue me from all this? But even when that happens and we have a great life for a little while, things go downhill again because I suspect something's wrong and I've killed her, or I've killed Julie, or I've killed somebody, and I'm in jail with this McCabe guy wearing a mask and we have to sort all this out. Why would he ever choose any of those things? This guy wants to punish himself and we don't really know why.
Well, it could just be dreams take you in a direction that's fun and flighty and forgettable, and sometimes dreams take you in some direction that's really introspective or threatening or scary or just anxiety-inducing or sad. So it could just be his subconscious taking him on that journey, and then tech support deciding after 150 years, well, hey, listen, we had to come in and step in and stop this nightmare. Do you want to wake up or what?
Yeah, they're telling him that he can actually literally be alive again 150 years in the future in, I guess, New York.
And in 150 years of dreaming, has this man experienced any growth?
I don't know that he has.
I don't know that he
because
has.
Because if we're talking about this movie being real until he does the splice after the nightclub sequence, which is about halfway through the movie, maybe a little past the halfway point. If that's what happens, and he commits suicide, and then they restart from there, and he supposedly gets better, but then doesn't again because he goes through all this where he imagines his face is ruined again until the very end. I forgot how much of the sequence at the end, tech support, and up on the roof with...
They shortened it, too. There's all these deleted scenes from that stuff, too, eh?
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, there's like a whole fight sequence with security in the lobby, but then they cut it all out, which, thank goodness, let's wrap.
Well, him being alone makes more sense than him fighting with security anyway. He should be alone in that sequence like he was in Times Square in the beginning when he has that dream. But then he and Noah Taylor on the roof discussing what had really happened, and in the elevator as well, too, that he's got the ruined face. I don't know if it's supposed to be real that it happened. Well, whatever's real in this whole movie. But it seemed like it would have been the crew's face. It's only at the very end when he sees Sophia again, and I think they hug or something, and when they pull away, that's when his face is back the way it was. And he supposedly jumps off the building. Knowing crews, he probably did that stunt with only cables. They were not on a real roof, I don't think. That looks like a very much visual effects shot, which it should. The vanilla sky
in
the background.
I've literally seen the green screen of him, quote, falling off that building.
There would be no reason for them to be on top of some tall skyscraper in New York City for that shot when it's supposed to be so surreal looking. Why actually have it really be on top of a skyscraper? But I could see crews saying, well, I'll jump, Cameron, or pretend to at least. And then he supposedly jumps to his death and wakes up. By the way, we're talking about dreams so much right now. This is the year of the puzzle film, Memento, Mulholland Drive, Donnie Darko, and this. But also, when you talk about dream films, Waking Life was this year as well.
Oh,
not so much
that?
A puzzle, but about dreaming for the whole film. Okay, I didn't talk about the numbers in this movie. There aren't that many of them. And this one is one of the bigger surprises I've had in a while, because whether or not you like the movie, or if I like it less than I used to, I'm still at least a thumbs up. But Rotten Tomatoes critics, 42% of them.
I was surprised by that, too.
Not only a splat, but a bad splat.
I know.
That's some of the numbers that Chris and I talk about with some of the terrible sports movies we've chosen to cover over the years.
I'm going to tear this movie apart, but I still would recommend it. I don't.
You give it 60 then. 60%
Well, I don't feel
like
it's a waste of time. Let me put it that way. There's a lot to like about it. Yeah. We're really dumping on it, but there are good things about it too.
So the average was 5.3 out of 10 on the strength of 170 reviews, but 72% of audiences. So they definitely did like the movie. The original by Amin Abar, I think I'm saying that name right, got 85 and 88% on
Rotten
Tomatoes.
Have you seen the original?
I did, but it's been a long time. I don't know if it's on the DVD. We watched this on Canopy, so we didn't know special features there. But I know I saw it, and I think the storyline is extremely close to the same. They didn't really change all that much in the Crow version. It was 20th at the box office in 2001. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, Philosopher's Stone, whatever, was number one. Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring was number two. We covered that, of course, because it was on the Top 100 Project, the AFI's list. Shrek, we covered a few months ago, was number three. And Legally Blonde was 22nd. We've covered all those. This has been a big year for 2001 films. We've covered more than just that from that year in this one, including AI, not that long ago. It was nominated for one Oscar, Paul McCartney's song, Vanilla Sky, but it didn't win that award. I used to think Cruise should have been nominated for an Oscar for this, but I don't think so much anymore. Although I still stand by Haley Joel Osment in AI.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And speaking of AI, I said this as soon as we finished the movie. AI and Vanilla Sky came out in the same year, and they share this thing in common, which is that they're both a good concept in the hands of the wrong director. While Spielberg and Cameron Crowe are both incredible directors with the right material, they make classic films and truly just watchable, wonderful films. But when they both tried to get really ambitious in this particular year and get really heady and philosophical, and they both failed. Cameron Crowe failed worse than Spielberg. I think AI is altogether, strangely, a more flawed yet better film. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Certainly a more interesting film. I would watch again way before I would watch Vanilla Sky again. But they're both failed by these directors that just don't have it in them to make something that's that heady and deep.
It's funny about Crowe because I always thought of him as one of my, maybe not favorite directors, but of the modern era, somewhere on that list. And yet, rethinking it today, because this movie for me, as I think you would agree, is a thumb up, but not as much as it was before we watched it about a week ago.
He tried to stretch himself a little bit and maybe...
And I do appreciate and applaud that.
Absolutely.
When directors or actors, writers, producers, whoever...
Yeah, artists fail.
Get out of their
the
comfort
time.
Zone. Mm-hmm. Because why not once in a while? It's a little bit irritating when somebody does the exact same thing over and over and over again. But it doesn't always work that well if you do try that. But Crowe did Say Anything, his first movie as a director. And of course, he wrote Fast Times before that. But his first movie as a director was Say Anything, which I still like a lot. Singles, fine, but I don't remember it all that well. But it's at least solid.
Yeah.
We talked about Jerry Maguire. I love Almost Famous and you don't, but that's 3 out of 4 that I would say are good to excellent films in this first batch, and even Singles is at least fine. We still think this has got a lot to recommend about it, so it's somewhere in that same Singles rank at least. But this is why I don't know if I can agree anymore, and I've always liked him as a guy. He's really good in commentaries and making ofs and things. Seems like he's a big heart. Funny I say that because he was married to Nancy Wilson from Heart, who did music in this, and of course music in Jerry Maguire. They're not married anymore. I didn't realize it's been about 10 years since they got divorced. She's remarried. I think he might be too, but she definitely is remarried since then.
She did the soundtrack for this film.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, that's why I bring her up. But everything since this movie, which is only 3 films, but Elizabethtown, We Bought a Zoo, and Aloha, Aloha's got an awesome cast, and I don't remember the movie. That's the thing about it. It wasn't even so much that I hated it. I don't remember anything about it. And this is a guy who made a movie with some of the most quotable dialogue of the last 40 years, probably, in Jerry Maguire, and Almost Famous. So those are two, and I used to think this was too, that are on some kind of mountaintop for him, top of a building, about to dive off maybe, and the other ones are in the basement.
Isn't it so?
Or maybe the third floor at best.
How many directors do we know who that's happened to? I was thinking about how Zemeckis made some of the greatest films of his generation and then fell off a cliff and
Rob
got
Reiner
super into
also.
Mocap. Rob Reiner. I had so much hope for Jason Reitman. He made one of my favorite movies of the century so far, Young Adult. I know that's a controversial statement. I'm sure a lot of people were expecting me to say something else. But since Young Adult, has he made a... Labor Day was
we hated it.
Barely watchable.
Good actors in that, too, and it wasn't
Do not have a lot of optimism for the new Ghostbusters film. The trailers look dismal.
Doesn't look funny, for sure. Now, then again, you look at people's resumes, and I've been working ahead on some of our future podcasts, a number of actors who haven't made a movie in years, but how could they for the past year and a half? Some have made movies. Some people have been working.
We know Cruise is
Cruise has, exactly. If I see it again, you're fucking fired. Which we agreed with, incidentally. A lot of people thought, oh, there's that fucking Scientologist. Hey, you know what? Obviously, Tom Cruise told his crew, making, it was one of the Mission Impossible movies, wear a mask and stop congregating, because if we get caught by the authorities or whatever, if we have to shut this down, or more importantly, if people get sick because you are so close together, then we don't have a movie, and maybe Hollywood won't make movies because we're, well, as he said, the gold standard for all this shit. His whole point was, I'm responsible for even more than just this movie. If that's his ego out of control, fine.
Oh, yeah.
But when I heard it and you heard it, we thought the same thing, and I still feel that way now. Maybe they fucking deserve to hear this stuff. And also, when you hear this stuff about mask mandates, and people will, of course, compare that to Nazi Germany and all that kind of stuff.
No, you're talking about vaccine passports. You said about mask mandates.
Well, also mask mandates. Okay, that too. Both of those things. Maybe humanity has proven, just like Cruise is set for Mission Impossible Part 12, whatever the hell it is, you don't fucking deserve it. You've been given a responsibility to wear a mask, and you don't do that, and you're not getting a vaccine, you're not doing that. Yeah, anyway, so I support him in that measure, and I think you do too.
There is a lot to be said about bullying and about workplace culture and how you should talk to people. There's plenty to be said about that. But just from me at home listening to that lecture, not in that room.
So cathartic.
So cathartic. I don't agree with talking to your employees like that. I'm just saying, if only he had, like, yelled it into Instagram or something instead of at some people's faces, then maybe it'd be better, but I was happy to hear it.
Before we all started getting the vaccine, if we were all congregated in my area, and I do work alone, like I've said before, but if there were three or four of us in the room and some authority figure came in and saw us maskless, sitting together, and they yelled at us, as much as we might hate that person, they would have been wrong. There are times when you have to be treated like a fucking child if you're going to act like a fucking child. And it sounds like his employees did in this movie, the crew, and then certainly a lot of Americans and Canadians and every other person in the world have been doing it through this pandemic. So anyway.
There are also times when it is literally impossible to make a movie or a TV show without getting within 6 feet of someone that you're working with. So it's an unfair standard to set and to try to
I think
to
they weren't wearing masks in that situation as part of the problem,
too. Okay, that's super dumb. But I was on a TV set last fall. What are you going to do? There were people doing hair and makeup. They're going to get within 6 feet.
Don't make the movie. Don't make the TV show.
Well, that's just it. If you actually expect people to stay 6 feet from each other, a camera operator and a DP are going to have to get close together.
If we were a grown-up culture, we wouldn't have had to be lectured like this by anybody, point, I guess. And we're not a grown-up culture. We're a bunch of babies. Let's get back to the movie.
Okay.
So I said it in the nutshell, move the fuck on about Julie. Obsessing about David to the point where she kills herself and almost kills him. And you could also argue that maybe he did die in that moment, and that's part of the whole fantasy of this movie, the angles you could take in this movie, the dreams, whatever. Forget the fact she killed herself and could have killed him. Just the fact that she won't get past it. I can sympathize with that. Everyone has obsessed about somebody that they want to be with before they find the person they're actually with, their wife or husband, if they find even that. But when somebody isn't committing to you, he doesn't even say I love you to Sophia, who he clearly is in love with, until the very end of the movie, which she doesn't know about, but we know that about him.
Yeah, but getting to know her, Julie, is not a point of this movie. The movie isn't trying to get to know Julie. She's just more of a plot device than somebody that we're supposed to really understand. She's a villain. She's an instigator.
It's always pissed me off in the scene with the car, which she does play pretty well. I don't really buy that she would flip. Rebecca De Mornay would have been awesome in that scene.
Yes! Oh my God, you're so right! It's just a failure of her performance, and maybe the script as well.
But the point about, I've swallowed your cum. Your body made promises whether you do or didn't.
Yeah, that's
are you
bullshit,
fucking kidding me?
Way.
What are you, five?
I know. Your body makes a promise. Girlfriend, what are you talking about?
And I've been shit on this way as much as I've ever shit anybody else. So if somebody's listening to this right now thinking, well, yeah, he's done that to other people. He's done that to women. Maybe I have. It wasn't intentional, but it's happened to me as much as, if not more than. Grow up. I heard this on a podcast recently where somebody was complaining for a long time about a guy ditching her for somebody else. And the guy who was having to hear this over and over and over again just said, he doesn't love you. And that may be cruel, but isn't that just the simple truth? If he doesn't want to be with you, then you want to force him to be with you? What, are you a fucking maniac like she obviously is?
But it's not like we're meant to, as an audience, examine her motivations. She is just cuckoo bananas. She is the plot device that it takes to get him to drive off of a bridge.
Yep. If this movie was a zeitgeisty film and still in the culture, which it is not, I guarantee you there'd be a lot of people out there saying, justice for Julie. There would be.
Yeah, I guess you could be right, but it's just not a very well-wrought character. Not like there is a single well-wrought character in this entire movie, because what is this movie about? about?
Well, Brian's pissed off. You had to go for her, the one girl I wanted, who you just met that day yourself.
Oh, another case I make for the unreliability of the first act of the film is that Brian says, I can't believe you're so blasé about being with Julie. She's my dream girl. And then later in the film, talking about Sophia, he says, you stole my dream girl. As if every girl that he has a crush on is his dream girl. But I wonder again if it's a failure of David's memory or if it's meant to be intentional. It kind of strikes me like something that's intentional.
There's nothing wrong with pining. Almost Famous, with a love triangle, where they're both pining for Penny Lane. And in the end, she ditches them both. She wants to be with Russell, but then he sells her to another band. And she doesn't want to be with somebody who's 2 years younger than she is. She's already a kid herself, and then he's basically a child, meaning William Miller. This movie has some of the same things going on here, and it also applies to Brian, what I just said about Julie. Move the fuck on! Why did he flirt with her? Because she flirted back. She didn't have to. Blame her, too. It's not just David's fault. Okay, yeah, maybe keep your hands off, but if they had chemistry and she has eyes for him, then you need to grow up as well.
So there's the whole scene at David's birthday party where the three of them are confronting each other and Brian is griping about the fact that they're hitting it off and he's the one that brought her to the party. Everything about that scene is so weirdly stilted and phony.
Cruz, in this scene especially, more than, well, maybe when he goes to work and he won't pick the cover, maybe more so there, he seems like he's playing as if he's just loaded.
Yeah, he's
drunk.
Or high on coke.
And at that party, okay, maybe. And at that party, that would make some sense, but during the day, I don't think that's supposed to be.
His eyes are wild.
Yeah.
And also, their dialogue is really far apart. There's lots of gaps. And this is a Cameron Crowe film. We know this man knows how to make a natural scene with great rhythm and flow. You know he knows when to get in and when to get out and how to have any two actors in a scene have amazing chemistry together. And then here we have this so awkward scene with Jason Lee, who is funny and cool, and Tom Cruise, who is charisma personified.
And can be funny and cool.
And they're in the scene together. It's so awkward that it feels like it's trying to be awkward. I wonder if that is intentional. But again, what is this movie about? Is it about vanity? What is it saying about vanity? David doesn't seem to be getting punished for his failure to accept his new face. He seems to be getting punished for doing Julie wrong, I guess. She's the one who's haunting him. But in a way, the movie is like, there's nothing wrong with killing yourself, giving up your company, your fortune,
your control
best
back.
Friend.
Why fight for it if you're going to kill yourself anyway?
He gives up all those things so that he can have his face back.
And his girl.
No, because the dream is an extra. That's just a bonus. He makes the decision to do it. He knows he's going to wake up so far in the future that his relationship with Sophia will already be gone. And she kind of broke up with him, right, at the nightclub. That's the last time she ever sees him. But he gives up everything so that he can be hot again. Is the movie about love? Because all the love we see in the film is a fantasy. Sophia certainly seems to be falling in love with David at the beginning, but we never see them as a couple in reality. They never were. Even in the real world, she has this really inconsistent presentation. Like I was saying, she's denying his impression of her when they see each other in the nightclub. And she seems like a completely different person in the nightclub who's deeply uncool about the way he's acting without the empathy that's kind of deserved somebody who's been through what he's been through. It's just so freaking strange.
Yeah, if you're going to see him in the nightclub, then at least be polite and civil.
And I could never really latch onto what the deal is with her. And then, of course, in the second two-thirds of the film, she's literally a dream girl, manic pixie dream girl.
Right.
But she's actually a figment of his imagination.
Most of this love story is not real because it's his dream.
Talk about a manic pixie dream girl. Cameron Crowe is one of the worst defenders of this.
Elizabeth
when people
Town.
Talk about manic pixie dream girl, one of the chief examples that they use is Elizabeth Town.
Kirsten Dunst.
I said in Almost Famous that I do feel like it's a more complex version, but Penny Lane has some very manic pixie dream girl qualities about her. So Cameron Crowe likes to make these fantasy fulfillment movies, these stories about a woman who's just so wonderful that she just fixes everything in your life. Not every movie he makes is certainly not true about Say Anything, and definitely not true about Jerry Maguire. I think Dorothy is a wonderful character with tons of depth, and she's very, very real. But here you have a movie where the manic pixie dream girl is taken to this next level where they're like, yeah, she's literally a dream. But maybe that's saying something about how men are like, how would I spend 150 years? Well, why don't you just make a woman who's so perfect that she fixes everything? And I don't know about every woman out there, but just about every woman I know has had a total creep, or at least someone who turned out to be a creep, say or imply to them that they could and would become a better person if we could be patient and fix them. It is a real annoying problem when you're trying to date as a woman. Back to the movie. Is the movie about acceptance? He has to come to accept that his life has changed. No, not really, because he doesn't accept it. They're implying that it's better for him to have made the choice that he made and then choose life at the end. That moment is so unearthly.
Kill yourself, but choose life.
I don't even know where to begin. But that moment just comes out of nowhere. It's so bizarre, and there's no emotional build-up to it.
You mean diving off the building and then waking up?
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, because he paid for this, obviously a lot of money, to live this way, this long, with Ellie, which would have evolved, and God knows what kind of technology and things they have as things go along. But why are these rules so strict against what he wants? If he just wants to wake up, why has he got to do something like jump up on the side of a building where he has a big fear of heights and then dive off, which of course is metaphorical. We've seen that in a lot of other movies.
Because it's cinematic.
I guess so. I do really like the one I hadn't heard until fairly recently, which is that Brian wrote all this thing. It's just his book.
Do you like that? Defend that, please.
Well, it's either that to me or that the entire thing is a dream that David's having. Before the credits started and after the credits ended, the entire thing is some kind of lucid dream. Either he is in the LE place many years in the future, probably 150 years in the future. Whether he had this life or not, maybe he was some Joe Average who imagines that he's this publishing magnate who had everything and then lost it and then got it back but lost all these goods and bads that came with his whole life because, of course, the sour and the sweet speech that Brian talks about.
Yeah.
Which comes up multiple times in this movie, too, where you need to have the sour to appreciate the sweet.
Is that what the movie's about, then? Because not really.
Well, that would also fit a little bit with the fact that this guy pays for something that tortures him so much and punishes him so much.
Well, it's not supposed to torture him, but it seems like his subconscious can't accept perfection. So it keeps introducing flaws and spins out of control.
Julie is the Smith of this because he keeps on having her come in there. There's a sequence, I always remember this so well from the first viewing, and it was one of those holy shit type things when you see her face in the pictures where Penelope Cruz's face had been. It's as if it was Cruz's family and friends and dogs and things that she was doing stuff with, and there are all these candid photos of her, but then it's Julie instead.
What thematically is that about? I'm asking because
I don't really know.
Right. Whatever themes they're trying to parse out with all of this wacky visuals and this whole puzzle, I just don't feel it. There's no emotional resonance whatsoever. He doesn't grow.
I don't feel
like there's any stakes.
He supposedly grows. You know a really key line, actually, is the night when they have their date, the one and only date they have, and again, whatever the reality is, but the supposed reality, the one that tech support says is a reality. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
So first he takes her up to a special part of his apartment, this awesome place in the Dakota building. But then it's a place where he only seems to take someone like her. I don't know if he would have ever taken Julie up there, for example. And then they go to her place. But rather than have sex or even really kiss, they do that maybe a little bit. They draw pictures of each other. Whoever drew that, that's a really good picture of Penelope Cruz, actually. And the one she draws of him is funny. It's more of a Beatles gag type picture.
I like how she's like a Venice Beach caricature artist all of a sudden.
The giant teeth, of course, certainly fits. But he does say, and here's the key line, I think she asks him if he's changed. I don't remember why she says that, but he says 5 minutes ago. So you talked a minute ago about women that can change you for the better. He's saying to her before he leaves, meets up with Julie and gets in the car accident and the rest of the story happens, that he's changed. For whatever reason, this couple of hours with this mediocre woman has made him a different person. He was going to go to work and fight for his company and try to actually be a good CEO of the David Ames Publishing Corporation, whatever the hell it was called. And Seven Dwarves be damned. It was going to be his company. He was actually going to do his job. 3 magazines he runs, by the way, not just one. But he was going to do his job based on meeting her. And again, I think that's why this movie used to make me feel like it was an 8 rather than a 10. Because I used to love this movie. But it was almost like, she changed you, really, this mediocre woman? Isn't
that
not pretty?
But even talk about his growth, that's all the first act. That's not the growth that a character needs to undergo.
But then he's put on hold because of the Julie accident and everything is taken away from him. It'd be like if you said you were going to make a big change in someone in your life before the pandemic and it was about being social, for example. And then suddenly weren't allowed to be social anymore. But maybe whenever we get the fuck out of this, next spring maybe, you get back
about,
to being social again.
We're just talking about the setup of the film. The rug is torn out from under him. He has to choose whether to live or not. And he's like, not... Basically, truly, what is the point of the second and third act of this film?
The movie at the very end is suggesting that now he's actually going to be literally alive again, though, too. In the far-off future, well, that does lead me to what happens next. If that's true, let's say that's actually what did happen, and David Ames, 150 years in the future, is awake and alive again, and obviously Sophia's long gone, and Brian's long gone. Julie was dead anyway.
His fortune's long gone. They say that. Okay. They say your money won't last long.
So David has to adjust to the real world 150 years in the future, but guys like him always succeed, so he'll be okay. He'll find a way.
Well, I mean, maybe he can just enjoy the novelty of being the caveman who was resurrected. That dog that defrosted was famous, so he could be famous.
I just got it. You know what the point of this movie is? This really is a Cruise project, if I'm right about this, and I'm probably not. This is speculation. Because it's Crow's movie. He wrote, directed, and all the rest. But Cruise and Crow both produced it.
Cruise optioned it.
And he bought it. He was watching the Amenábar version and said, I'm buying this. And even before the movie's over, I'm buying the rights to this. And they were both producers, along with Paula Wagner, who was then Cruise's partner in all his production ventures. Maybe it's a Scientology thing.
Oh, no.
Or the way Cruise was before Scientology, from the beginning of his career, I'm going to will myself to be good in this movie and make this movie successful. I'm going to will it. I may have a ruined face and a bad arm and serious pain, but I'm going to will science into fixing all those things for me. It will happen.
The Academy into giving me an Oscar.
Or I'm going to will that I don't have dyslexia anymore. And I don't need psychiatry, so maybe this is some kind of Scientology subtext also.
Oh, yeah, maybe some psychiatrist did him wrong at some point in his life. But we haven't really talked about the psychiatrist character in this film, McCabe.
Kurt Russell,
played by Kurt Russell, who Crow cast because he was introduced to him by Kate Hudson, who is his stepdaughter.
Of course, yeah. Well, we've covered Russell now three times. The Thing, excellent movie. Everyone loves that now, but didn't at the time. The Hateful Eight, we did that just last year. And then Chris and I did him in Miracle in Scoring at the Movies. You don't think of Kurt Russell as somebody with a great amount of range, but those are four different performances without a doubt, especially either The Thing or Hateful Eight, because they're similar-ish at least. And then Coach in Miracle. And now this role where he's playing, as it's made very clear, an Atticus Finch-type mentor.
Let's be honest, though. He's better in a certain kind of part than he is in other kinds of parts. He's better in The Thing in Hateful Eight than he is in this movie.
I liked him in this movie. I love the moment where tech support says to him about the daughters. What are their names? Look on his face tells you that this digital creation doesn't know. I thought Russell was actually quite fine. He maybe isn't quite old enough to play a mentor to Cruise's character. Not that he has to be 30 years older.
To be honest, I find all those scenes completely pointless and annoying. One of the major flaws for me in this film is the editing, the way that scenes felt like they were thrown in willy-nilly, especially those psychiatry scenes. They come in and they go out and it makes you really confused about where in the film you are. They don't really do a good job of the time jumping, and I guess they're supposed to be telling the story, but they're annoying. The whole room, the drama of it.
It says dream on the blackboard backwards.
Spare me.
Did you notice that the first time? I didn't notice until I read later.
God, that's so dumb.
I think it's supposed to be that L.E. puts this character in this thing, in this case, for David to work out his issues.
Yeah, and the film puts it in there for him to just yell and lament his situation and confuse us and try to make the film seem a lot more clever than it actually is.
And wear his mask.
They did some really cool things with this mask. Visually, this film actually has some excellent moments, some of Crow's best work. Of course, a lot of it was borrowed from Open Your Eyes, mm-hmm. the Spanish version, especially the mask stuff in the nightclub where he has it on the back of his head.
I love
head.
That, yeah.
Oh, it's so cool.
And then him stumbling
it's
around
drawn
drunk.
Pretty much straight from the Spanish film. So we can't give Crow the credit for that, but the fact remains that shit is awesome. Mm-hmm. The car crash, outstanding. Mm-hmm. What an incredible scene. I've watched it so many times. I found it on YouTube.
Crashes,
I watched it over and over again because it is visceral and real and fast and violent and incredible.
If you think about it, how did he survive that car crash? She died in that accident.
He doesn't have a seatbelt on, I don't think.
Right. He would have probably gone right through the windshield at that speed when it crashes that thoroughly. Now, also, people have pointed out you can see the cable that pulled the car off the bridge.
I'm not looking at the cable.
Because it goes a little slow motion. You can see it flopping down on the ground, but it's not a big deal. You see that in Speed, too. When the first bus blows up, the bus is being pulled along after his buddy, he'd been getting coffee, Keanu had, and his buddy drives off, and then kaboom! And you see the bus being pulled on a cable, just the cable, not the thing pulling it, in a wide shot. But you don't notice that the first time you see the movie, you don't really care.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, that shot is so vivid for sure. But if you think about it, the passenger of a car accident like that should have died as much as, if not more than, the driver. Because the driver would have had
the steering wheel to at least stop
which them. Maybe would have wrecked her even more. I don't know. But they make it clear in this fantasy, this world, whatever you want to call it, that she died in that accident, but she haunts him anyway. So it's a ghost movie in some ways, too. And in the same year as this, he produced the woman he was divorcing that year, Nicole Kidman, and The Others, which, of course, is a ghost movie, which we'll cover within the next couple of weeks.
I've never seen it.
You've never seen The Others?
No, I've never seen it.
So Cruise and Kidman were still married when they started making that movie. I don't know how involved Cruise was, but he was involved somehow as a producer. Then he got divorced. He apparently did it on the set. He told the crew about this, cause I guess because he realized it'd be a big deal. We've never found out exactly why, and then he started dating Penelope Cruz for a few years after this movie. So anyway, this was a big year for ghost movies for these two people, because Kidman's movie is clearly a ghost movie, and this movie, if you think about it, has a ghost with Cameron Diaz's character haunting him. Now, the link with Kidman and Cruz is that only 2 years before 2001... Eyes Wide Shut came out.
Yes.
A movie with dream themes and
there's so many similarities.
A very key mask.
Yeah, there's mask stuff. There's marital discord.
It also has a Truman Show ending because he's given this choice. Do you stay asleep or do you literally wake up? And if you literally wake up, are you going to be the guy with the wrecked face and the bad arm and the headaches? I guess not, but I'm not really sure. But then again, you would think that medical science...
Yeah, the whole point of cryogenically freezing yourself is to chill until they they figure out a cure for what ails you. So they would figure out a cure for his headaches, for his face, for his arm, all the ways that his body was destroyed by the drugs he used to overdose with.
With what money, if he had to give most of that up, or doesn't really have the fortune he once did, at least.
I guess.
You would think that they would have some kind of money. You know the relationship of this movie, by the way, speaking of somebody that actually does care about in this film, that I would love to see, and I don't know if they did anything else together. If they did, it's nothing major I can think of, but Cruise and Timothy Spall.
Who's Timothy Spall again?
He plays Thomas Tip. He's the guy who's an executive who actually is nice to David and helps him out.
Oh, I agree.
The main reason why he doesn't lose his company to the Seven Dwarfs.
Yes. For what reason? Then he kills himself anyway. But they do have
Thomas
a lovely relationship.
Would have known about this, because I don't think it would have been a secret that this guy's going to this high-tech thing, the LE company, the Lucid Dream thing. And Thomas would have made sure that future David would have been taken care of, I think.
Also, though, is he going to keep his company? Is he going to lose his company? All this set up for nothing. Because who cares in the end? They completely drop it.
Well, I mentioned The Truman Show a second ago, and we love that movie. The end of that is all about, do you want a regular life without it being this thing we've been watching for the past hour and 40 or so minutes in Truman Show, and in this movie for a lot longer, more like 2 hours and 10 minutes. Do you want a real life? And both Truman and David choose the real life, and we don't know what's going to happen from that point on, but that's the idea. Which is also so funny about people like Cruz and Jim Carrey, who are so under a microscope that they can't have a real life ever again.
True. Now, in Truman Show, that moment is so earned that it is one of the greatest endings in cinema. In this movie, it comes out of nowhere completely. The whole thing is a mystery anyway. We don't know what's happening to him. We assume he's going mad. And then we're like, oh no, he's not going mad. This is all a dream. And oh wait, it's 150 years in the future and he has to decide whether to wake up or not. And he's like, I'm going to wake up. But there's no reason for the audience to care whether he wakes up or not. And incidentally, wouldn't that have been a way more interesting movie if they skipped the whole dream part and they just took this playboy who had everything going for him and they skipped ahead 150 years, took away his fortune and made him adjust to life where he doesn't have everything handed to him, he's a stranger in a strange land? That would be a way more interesting movie than what happened while he was asleep.
Okay, maybe so. But Cruise didn't want to make that movie, neither did Crow, I guess.
Come on, somebody make that movie. I want to see it.
So we've covered Cruise at least 3 times, maybe there's more, but Rain Man, Interview the Vampire in recent years. Penelope Cruz, good in the Spanish language films, but not so good in this. But this is the first time we've ever covered her, and let's hope it's the last. Jason Lee was in Dogma and Almost Famous in the past for us. And of course, My Name is Earl was his big thing on TV. Cameron Diaz, Shrek, and Being John Malkovich. Talked about Kurt Russell already, of course. Timothy Spall does a lot of things with Mike Lee, the Harry Potter films, and Chris and I covered him not long ago in The Damned United. Noah Taylor was in Almost Famous. He's Dickie, the band manager, and then later did Edge of Tomorrow with Tom Cruise, a movie you like an awful lot. I like it too, but I think you're even a bigger fan than I am of that one. Live, Die, Repeat, and they apparently will do a sequel to that one day.
Ah.
Tilda Swinton has the small role as one of the people at L.E. was in Adaptation and Grand Budapest Hotel.
She's one of the actors that went on to become much bigger than their small parts in this film.
There's a lot of people in small parts
like
in this
movie. Yeah, like Johnny Galecki is in it. It's funny because it's not like he was a nobody going into this film. He was David from Roseanne. Mm. But then, of course, he went on to star in, regrettably, one of the biggest sitcoms of the 21st century.
The Big Bang
God,
Theory. Michael Shannon does play the guard Shannon. And I don't know who that was at that time, although he'd been in Groundhog Day before, but I didn't know him then either. But now he's gotten some pretty big things. Steven Spielberg has a small role in this. Yes. He's the guy who says, ironically for a guy who himself seems like such a Boy Scout, says, "Happy birthday, you son of a bitch," as he hugs Cruise. And of course, they were going to make Minority Report not that many months after this.
I like how everybody's dressed to the nines at that party, but Spielberg is just dressed in his
uniform. It was a literal walk-on. And then Crow and Diaz are both in Minority Report in small roles. They're both on the train when Crow's
Cameron
character...
Cameron Crowe is a small role in that,
and so is Cameron Diaz. The movie's 185-1. We saw it on Canopy, so the library service, although we do have the DVD. The cinematographer, John Toll, as did Joe Hutching, worked on Almost Famous, so he's the editor, Hutching is. But Toll won Oscars for Legends of the Fall and Braveheart, quite a pedigree coming to this film then. It does look pretty good. And Hutching had two Oscars also in the Oliver Stone movies, JFK, Born on the 4th of July. Mark Lavolsi, who also edited the movie, did mostly comedies, and we talked about Nancy Wilson doing what there is for score, but like most Crow movies, it's classic rock and songs he likes. Good Vibrations, I already said, is in this film. So it's mostly pop songs, but then you got Nancy Wilson doodling on her guitar, just quietly, almost like she's just making up on the spot. So the technicals, you think, at least are pretty good in the film, although it is way too long.
Yeah, the editing is a total disaster. Each individual scene does not have a natural flow, in the sense that the order that the scenes are presented in are both confusing and disorienting, not in the good way. Cinematography, it looks very pretty. It's supposed to look very pretty. The Spanish version of the film had a much more gritty, realistic look, which I think raises the stakes in some way. When you make a film really glossy and pretty, I don't know, it just doesn't feel as dangerous or edgy. So literally the sky is vanilla, just like the painting that he has by one of the famous impressionists. I can't remember which one. They digitally make everything even prettier than it was. And it's fine. It looks great. And like I said, there's some very cool images in this. This is a very fun film to watch for the sake of that. Also, Cameron Crowe can't make a boring movie. It's a pretty entertaining film. It has some great forward momentum, as much as it's messy and the story doesn't pay off. And I think in many ways it's a failure. It's entertaining. You're engaged throughout. I actually really like the way he did the madness at the end with all of the audio overlapping and Good Vibrations and everything getting really crazy. It felt not just effective, but also edgy and daring. For a movie with this kind of budget, with this kind of pedigree, it's good, of course, but it's a little disappointing.
Well, the first thing I said when it was over, you looked at me and said, "You give me your thoughts first," because usually I ask you what you think of a movie we've just watched, especially if one of us hasn't seen it in a long time, or it's always you, have never seen it. So I went first and I said, "I wish it was better."
100%.
I never liked Penelope Cruz in the film, but I thought Cruz was awesome, and instead it's more like, good, but yeah, you're really trying. And then I wish it was even better than it is. I would still give it a thumb up, but barely now. But maybe that's what the problem is with this movie for me. I've just grown out of it.
We're ripping on Cameron Crowe, but for somebody's career to have the absolute classics in it that he has, any filmmaker should be so lucky as to have left a legacy like that. Then he started to challenge himself and maybe discovered that he has a niche.
I tip my hat for that, for at least trying.
No, totally. I admire people for taking risks.
Love when he was in his wheelhouse, Jerry Maguire, and Almost Famous. Okay, so that was the last of the puzzle films, Memento, Mulholland Drive, Donnie Darko, and in some ways, Waking Life, I guess, is more of a dream film. And the other three certainly have stood up more, but Donnie Darko was just this year, Mulholland Drive and Memento and other years. All those are in our archives if you want to listen to what we thought about the year of the puzzle film, 2001. In 7 days, it'll be getting closer to Scary Movie Month, so let's start raising some goosebumps as we dig into the follow-up to Bev's favorite movie, the decades-in-the-making sequel to The Shining, Dr. Sleep. The coming attraction's opinion question for Dr. Sleep. What is your favorite horror movie sequel of all time? It's not this one.
Spoiler. It's not Dr. Sleep. All right, so for our answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Dr. Sleep. For more from us, you can go to our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 07 lists of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. Please leave us a rating and a review. that helps people find us. Ryan and I are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project. It's all one word, top100project. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
This episode's already gone long, but I'm going to add one more little theory at the end here. He's going to come back as a cat. Because as it's said many times in the film, I will see you in another life when we are both cats.
So annoying.
Which apparently Penelope Cruz said to Cameron Crowe when there was some kind of struggle. I think she was mad when she said it at him, and he liked the line so much that it plays many times in the film. And Tom does say that to Penelope at the end, right before, I believe, he jumps off the building. In any case, Bev, every passing minute is a chance to end this podcast. So please do.
Cut!